Hello, everyone, and welcome again to UFOs and the Paranormal Over Our Heads. I'm your host, Preston Dennett, and each week we, of course, explore the subject of UFOs and the paranormal. And UFOs, I have to admit, are my favorite, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. Our guest is Ed McBride, and we're going to be talking about UFOs over ancient Egypt. And boy, you guys are in for a treat tonight, because I tell you, this guy has a lot of really astounding information. But before I introduce him and get to our subject, let me give you just a little bit of UFO news, because of course, no surprise, there's a lot of stuff going on. Here's a report from Oregon. This occurred in mid-May over Gearhart, Oregon. A gentleman who prefers to remain anonymous says that on the night of May 11th at around 10:20 p.m., his sister-in-law stepped outside because she smelled a skunk. And looking up, she saw a bright light out of the northeast traveling across the sky. Other relatives drove up at the same time and also saw it too. And that is when this witness actually came out and also observed the object. There was no sound. It was not like an aircraft. It was bigger than a star. It was a brilliant light that sort of jiggled around and was strobing with four rapidly changing colors, including red, blue, white, and green. You know, this is something I seem to notice a lot with these UFOs, is these brilliant, striking colors. I'm not exactly sure what the reason for this, if it's a display or if it has something to do with their engines, but it's something I see over and over again, and it really makes me wonder. We got a lot of other stuff going on. You know, I'm paging through the UFO news clipping service, and if any of you are UFO investigators out there, this is something you should really look into, the UFO news clipping service edited by Lucius Farish. And I'm amazed by how many people are actually taking cell phone pictures and videotapes of UFOs, and actually ghosts. In fact, Ireland's leading ghost hunter, his name is Carl Nally, he and his team spent, 13 hours in a jail that is known to be haunted, in a prison. This is, which prison is it here? I have it written down somewhere, but at any rate, they spent 13 hours in there, in the most haunted cells, and one of the guys actually caught on film these orbs of light, two of them. And so it's a pretty amazing case. It's actually the old Wicklow jail, and this is in Ireland, in Dublin, Ireland. So it's pretty interesting. Another man, his name is Tony Hicks, and he took a videotape of a apparent UFO over South End, England, and he put it up on YouTube. It's already attracted 3,500 hits, and it appears just to be kind of a light, but at any rate, there's so much of this happening. Here's another kid, Neil Wilcox. He actually took a picture of a red light in the sky. What's interesting about this is that numerous people around the area were also observing this light, and he was the only one who actually ran and got a camera and took a picture of it. Two fishermen actually saw this red light, they say, dive into the sea. So, I don't know. Here's a last little UFO report I want to share with you. This is someone who reported to MUFON that on July 13, 2007, this year, his 11-year-old daughter and relatives were flying from New York City's LaGuardia Airport to Florida, and the kid took the window seat, the 11-year-old daughter, and she says she saw something moving around the wing of the plane. She thought very quickly and reached for her cell phone and actually recorded this object in motion. And this object was apparently a small ball of light, was keeping the same speed as the plane, but was moving around the wing. And she recorded two events within 2 minutes. And her father has viewed this footage, and he says he's going to post it, download it to MUFON, and as soon as possible. So we'll see what comes of that. Anyway, it's a lot of stuff going on. Now let's get to our guest, because this is really an amazing subject. You don't hear a lot about this. Of course, we know that UFOs have been seen around for thousands of years. We've got a lot of evidence that UFOs have visited us way back thousands and thousands of years ago. For example, I mean, there's the ancient E.T. rock art. Petroglyphs in Toro Muerto, Peru, show large figures with large transparent helmets, and these rock carvings are dated about 11,000 B.C. And in the Sahara Desert on the Tassili Plateau in Africa, there are sculpted rock figures, again with large round heads like helmets, and these statues date back to around 6,000 B.C. It's all over the world. Figures carved into rock in Lumaki, Nambu province in Africa show figures seeming to wear spacesuits, and these are dated 4,300 B.C. Another example comes from the Australian Aborigines. They have numerous rock paintings throughout Australia, and they are known to be dated around 3,000 years old. There's a Colombian artifact that looks just like the space shuttle, a pre-Japanese sculpture that looks like an astronaut inside a pressurized spacesuit. These artifacts are at least 3,000 years old. So what's interesting about all this is most of these people just recorded these incidents through art. But our guest tonight has actually uncovered some amazing records, very, very detailed records of an incident over ancient Egypt. Our guest tonight, Ed McBride, has actually had a lifelong interest in Egypt and all these things and sort of stumbled into the UFO aspect of it. And tonight, that's what he's going to talk about, and I'm very excited. Ed, thank you for coming on to the show.
It's a real pleasure and an honor to be here. My main goal is to get this information out. It's quite amazing to me because I didn't plan on uncovering a UFO. I was getting ready to write a book about ancient Egypt. And what I did was I wrote a book about the Mexican Revolution. I couldn't get anyone interested in it. I did 7 years of intense research on this subject. I speak fluent Spanish. So because of that, though, it gave me a work mode, and I decided, well, I'm going to do one on Egypt. So I got every book I possibly could on Egypt. I wanted to learn the ancient language, which was no longer spoken. It went out of use about the time of Christ. They call it, actually it's Re Kemet is what the language is called, and the country was not called Egypt, it was called Kemet. Anyway, I don't want to get too involved, but in order for you all to understand what happened, you'll have to get a little crash course here in a very small amount of time of what the country was really like and what they're not telling you, and it's not a conspiracy, it's just that they're more comfortable with presenting it in a certain aspect. But the country was called Kemet. It was never called Egypt. That happened at the time of the Greeks. And almost everything we have today is recorded from the time of the Greeks and Romans. And if you don't believe it, look at the New York Times crossword puzzle, because there's nothing in there about Egypt or Kemet. Kemet, the word Kemet, we get that word for alchemy or chemistry. Chem means dark. And they use it for the land, the fertile land, the strip of the Nile River, which was called the Hapi, not the Nile. But anyway, that's what they use a farm with. And that was their whole civilization, was this strip of land that they needed so desperately to farm with. Came from the Mediterranean all the way down into inner Africa, the upper Egypt.
This is important history, and
yeah,
people don't hear about it. So.
Yeah, well, the thing is, we can't go too deep in it. Well, we got to set the base of what happened to this setting, because otherwise people will be really, really confused. So
right.
You have this group of people. You have these people, about 4 million people or so, that are living in this narrow strip of land that's good for agriculture. And then on each side of it, you have desert land, and that's where we get the word desert, because desh in ancient Kemetian means red, or like, for instance, like the red lands we used to call it. It's not bright red, but it's a sandy color red.
Right.
And air is of, and ta is land. So desert ta is our modern word desert, and no one knows that.
Wow.
But anyway, so they had this narrow strip of land. And their religion was more or less based on like a pyramid structure. They believed in a single god, but it was more or less like a corporation. If you wanted to buy a new car, for instance, you didn't go to the president of the car company and say, I want to buy a new car. You'd go to the local dealer. Well, that's like their religion worked. In order to get anything done, you had to go to the local priest, local god and get that more or less transferred upstairs, so to speak. So they did believe it was a monotheistic religion, but they had many, many gods in the lower level. We have the same thing with angels and so forth.
Right, okay.
So getting that aside, you had two major religions, and what happened was, again, I don't want to get too detailed, but this is very important. There was a group that entered this country. They were at peace, and this group entered, and they were very sophisticated as far as technology was concerned. They were called the Hyksos, and they came in prior to Tutankhamun, as an example, and they laid waste to the country for 160 years. They took it over. They came in with laminated bows and chariots, two things the commissions did not have. And they took over the country. Well, the commissions very carefully figured out how to build these laminated bows and how to build the chariots. They did a very good job, better than the Hyksos, I believe, and drove them out of the country. Then they got their country back, and they went to that was their empire. They had their empire. And because of this invasion of the Hyksos, they rallied around the new god, and they made a composite god. There was a god of to the north, toward the Mediterranean, called it was the city of Anu, and it was Ra, that was the sun god. But to the south, inland, was this god called Amun, the hidden one, and they made this one god out of two, Amun-Ra, and they rallied around, and then they drove the Hyksos out. So this god, because of what he did in rallying around him, he had all kind of special benefits from the government, so to speak. He was very strong.
Right.
But the real religion of Egypt, the one of the people, was the one of what we know as Horus and Isis and Osiris and so forth. Now, those are Greek names, because the real name was Heru. Heru was very important. This has to do with the UFO later on. But anyway, Heru was very, very, very important. He was the hawk god. You might see pictures of a hawk.
Right.
And Osiris was the god of the underworld, and Aset was what we know as Isis, the good wife of Osiris. We can't go too much more into this, but let's say that there was this, what I call a family religion. And that set the basis for all this, because what you have coming up here is a society not unlike the United States of today, where people are coming in from all over. There's a lot of commerce, a lot of industry. It's the center of the world, so to speak. It's like our country. It's very similar, very, very similar that way.
Now, and they had agriculture and lighting and all this stuff.
Yes, they did. And let me tell you a funny thing. They didn't have the dam. So every year, it was very iffy about the Nile or the Hapi River, because if that river rose too high, it'd flood everything. And if it wasn't high enough, then they'd be without food. So the pharaoh decided to put out a thing called edifices called Rehetches. And Rehetches, there were storehouses. And when you went to plant your crop along the Nile, if you were a farmer, you received a tax bill before you received any of the seeds, because they knew how much water you'd be getting. They had Nileometers up and down the river, or I guess you call them Hapiometers.
Right.
And they would know how much water would arrive at your premise, and the taxmen would come around and give you a bill of how much you would have to pay the government, and they took that percentage of your crop and put it in the Rehetches in case next year you had a low produce year.
Wow, taxes way back then. Wow.
Yes. Believe me, I don't know if it's as bad now when they give you a tax bill before you plant anything, but the tax man cometh. He was way back then. And they had court system. They had a very good court system. Women had equal rights to men. This is all very different today, you know. It was a very extremely interesting place. But I wasn't into the UFO angle. I was translating these works, this cursive script that they use, which is the equivalent of the hieroglyphics. You can't write all those birds and squares, you know, taking dictation when you're a scribe. It has to be in a more abbreviated form. But it's like we write. As an example, the picture you've seen, the Egyptian hieroglyph of an owl, you kind of see it as kind of, you know, it's sitting on a little branch, a real quick rendition of an owl.
Right.
Well, if you were to take an outline of the front of it and go by the feet, loop it up around the chest, and loop it up around the head, it'd be like a sideways M. Well, that owl has an M sound. And believe it or not, I think that's where we got our M in our alphabet today, except we put it upright. So the sideways M is the word M, and that's how they wrote it as an example in hieratic, what they called hieratic. It was a cursive script that they wrote. It is the same. It's not shorthand. They're all the same things that they're writing, but much quicker, in a much quicker fashion. It's like our writing.
Right.
And so that's how they did. Now the scribes, the one thing that what we're getting to here is people say, well, yeah, they made the story up, or this is something we can't believe that. The most important thing to a scribe was honesty. It was the most important thing in their religion was honesty. You didn't have, with rare exception, ever any crooked scribes. These were young people. They started them at 5 years of age, and by the time they were 15, they were working for the government.
Wow.
They had really good jobs. Now, that means they had to understand how to write very quickly under not the best conditions. And what they wrote on, Preston, they wrote on, they had these things called ostraca. These are modern names. It was a piece of limestone, irregular. What they would do was... papyrus, you know, paper wasn't invented. That came from China. So papyrus, in order to make papyrus or something, you know, you've seen these scrolls of papyrus, very labor-intensive. You have to take the papyrus and take something almost as thin as a razor blade, slice it in real thin lines, and go horizontally, and then another bunch vertically, and glue it together, and then burnish it and use it. Well, you can see how long this would take. I mean, these are the stalks in the papyrus plant. So they would go to the quarries, and they would get cast off slices of stone. Now, these were not heavy stones. These were thin slices, and they would write on them. Now, these guys are 15 years, 16 years of age. They were good. They were very quick. They wrote very well. Very few mistakes, by the way. Very few mistakes. They put it on these stone slices. That was all their communication of everything, from tax bills, from they kept records of everything. Their biggest thing they did in this country was keep records. They kept records of everything.
And were these carved onto the stone? No.
They were written with a very high-quality ink. They had a black ink. I don't know exactly what was in the ink composite, but they also had a red ink for highlights or for the few chances of errors they had. And they use red or black ink, and mostly black. They'd use it sketch or something or picture something. They do it in red ink, but mostly it was black ink. Now, they had different categories of scribes. You had your best scribes or your literary scribes. These are the ones that the temple used and the government used and so forth for really high-quality work. Then you had your scribes that just did accounting, and they took lists of how many onions are, you know, for the workers. And they had a very simple diet back then, too. So they mostly ate onions, bread, and beer. That's a lot, almost all they ever had.
Wow.
It seemed like they had, once in a while, they would have some special days, some holidays. And boy, would they like those holidays. And that's what we're coming up onto, was this big event. Are there any questions, Preston, at this time?
At this point, no. I'm just really
okay.
Very interested.
Okay, so we have a country that is mostly peopled by pretty happy people. At a relatively time of peace, they did have incursions. They had people breaking into the country, coming in illegally, and sometimes we're not talking about people just, you know, coming across the border looking for work. We're talking about caravans of people coming in armed with their families and everything else, just crashing in. And they had to fight them off too sometimes. But generally speaking, it was relatively safe where they were located.
Okay, then wait, yeah. I do have one question. What time period are we talking about here?
The time period that we're going to be covering tonight is 1203 B.C. Now, that is 3,200 years ago.
Wow.
Okay, so what happened was they didn't know anything about this country of Kemet. And let me go by the name here. Kemet. Okay. That was the name at Kemet, means dark land, and Kemta. Okay, Kemeta means dark land. But where did Egypt come from? Well, Egypt, the Greeks gave it that. They went to this place called Menefer, which means, you know, very pretty buildings, literally. They changed the name to Memphis. By the time the Greeks came in the scene, there wasn't any Egypt left. Cleopatra was Greek, and it had just about disappeared. After 5,000 or 6,000 years of existence, it no longer was really the same country.
Right. It's my understanding the Greeks were mystified by the
They couldn't
whole thing.
Figure it out. They couldn't figure the place out because an awful lot of the knowledge was held in the temples, and we will cover that later on. What we have here is a description of something that happened in a huge event with many witnesses. We're talking between 300,000 and 600,000 witnesses. that was apparently documented at least three times in intricate detail. So it's not like, you know, a little report in the San Diego Union or something. It's quite detailed. But the name Egypt. The Greeks came to this place, and what it was a temple. They kept visiting this temple, and it was called a temple to the Ka of the god Ptah. And Het is temple, and Ka is spirit, and Ptah was one of their gods. It was an edificer. I won't get into the religion, but anyway, he's one of their gods. So Het Ka Ptah, they said, let's go to Het Ka Ptah. Well, that means temple of the Ka of the god Ptah. Well, Het Ka Ptah morphed into Egypt. And it became Egypt, which you're naming a country over a temple. This isn't right. I mean, this is what happened, and no one knows. So I called Egyptologists up, and I said, how come you guys are calling this, how come you're not calling it Kemet? And all these books I got, they said the real name of the country is Kemet, and we're very happy with the way it is now. But I said, that's not what it was called. It'd be like calling the United States by some goofy name 3,000 years later, It's not correct.
Well,
you're not going to get them to change. And so, but to their credit, because I'm not against Egyptologists, they were responsible for preserving all these artifacts from ancient Kemet, because at the time, in 1900, 1880, 1890, when this thing was found that I translated, they were spiriting them out of the country because the local populace was just breaking them in half. They'd find these pieces of stone with the writing on them, they couldn't read it, so they'd break them in half and sell them as two antiquities instead of one.
Oh.
And so Budge, E.A. Wallace Budge, is a brilliant Egyptologist. He wrote, he had the hieroglyphic dictionary. You can get all these books through, I think, I got mine through Dover Publication. I don't know about today. I think they're still available. The Book of the Dead, and you got the Osiris, the gods of the Egyptians, and he had many, many, many books of excellent, excellent books. I got the later dictionaries. I got the Sprecher Pharaon, and if my German's not very good, I guess, but it's a German dictionary, and that was the latest one they used, so I got to have the German dictionary to translate the hieroglyphic dictionary in German. I use that as a backup for Budge's hieroglyphic dictionary, and I also had to make my own books and translating or creating a hieratic script for all the marks in the hieroglyphic language. So in other words, I wanted to be able to, because there's this huge book. Okay, I'm getting ahead of myself. But here's what happened. They took all these things out of Egypt, okay? They took them all out, and they took them to London, they took them to, Germany, Europe, and so forth. And they begin to notice that although they lasted thousands of years, these bits of ostraca, these slices of stone with the nice black, writing on it,
right?
They were starting to crumble in the damp climates.
Oh.
So they said, oh, we have a problem. So what they did was they got together, these two brilliant Egyptologists. One guy's name was Alan Gardner, and another one, Jaroslav Czerny. They got together, and what they did was they rounded up all these pieces that they could, and they got some almost like counterfeiters, and they traced these things, and I mean trace it. They had to go ahead and they had to take the rough stone, they had to put a gelatin over it, trace it with new ink, take the gelatin off, and copy tracing paper over it, and then get ready for publication. You see how laborious this could be.
Right, well.
So they had something like, there's about 600 pieces in this book. They did one page in hieroglyphic, the other page in hieratic, no English translation. They didn't have time. They left it for future generations. Well, this book was compiled, it was called Hieratic Ostraca, and it was compiled in 1957. So I got a hold of this book in my early days, trying to, studying Egypt, and at the time I was going to write the book. And I came across this page, and I said, what is this? And it says, a regular stone, and I didn't have a chance to send, Preston, to send you a copy of this. I will send you one. And it shows this temple servant cowering, holding his hand above his eyes from a glare or something in the sky. He's naked. Well, servants didn't wear clothes, and it was 125 degrees anyway. But servants didn't wear clothes, and he was not Egyptian, I can tell in the details. Anyway, he's, and it says, Hail to these, the Hagag, and it means hail, and it's the name of what the Egyptologists thought was a demon. this thing's coming forth. We're getting ahead of the story. I found this thing, and I couldn't make it out. I said, what is this thing? So I translate. I look at the bottom of the page, and there's a little clue to what it's supposed to be. It says, invocation to a demon. And I said, oh, okay, whatever. You know, and I made a note of it, and I Xeroxed it, and you know, a bunch of other things, and forgot about it. Then I began trying to figure it out. I said, this doesn't sound like an invocation. It sounds like something else. It's like they're describing something in the sky. I couldn't figure it out. So I gave a talk to a Mensa group, this Orion Society, locally here, and they said, why don't you get a copy of that big book? I said, well, it was on library loan from UCLA, and it's very valuable. It's a huge book. I mean, it's about 4 foot by 3 foot.
Wow.
And, you know, it's the biggest book. The librarian says, we got the biggest book you've ever seen here. Well, a friend of mine helped me acquire it through out of London, and I got it in about 2.5 days or 2 days from United Kingdom. I couldn't believe it. And I opened it up, and there is the picture of the servant cowering above this demon Sahagug in the sky. And then there's a note at the bottom. It says, for more on the demon Sahagug, and I didn't see this the first time, it says, see the back of the book. I go back there, and there's another report with 30 remarks about this thing. And that's what we're dealing with. So, any questions right now?
No, let's get into it.
Okay,
I mean, this is fascinating.
Okay, we're spending a lot of time in the backup, so here's what we had. I'm going to read this. This is going to explain the whole thing, and it's going to explain exactly what happened. It's easier than I can, you know, just say it, paraphrasing. After 15 years of studying and translating ancient Egyptian hieratic writing, I have located two reports of a very strange anomaly that manifested in the skies over southern Egypt 3,200 years ago. Approximately 1203 BC, on the 29th of July, at the capital city of Wast, Thebes, an object appeared concurrent with the annual coming forth of the star Sept, Sirius. The arrival of the star Sept marked the new year season of Shemut and the inundation of the Nile, or Hapi. Due to the Nile flooding, all work stopped and a 20-day holiday was observed, Festival of Apet of Amun-Ra. Approximately between 300,000 and 600,000 Egyptians would participate as the gilded boats of Pharaoh and the god Amun-Ra passed down the river from Karnak to Luxor. The crowds cheered, enjoying the pomp, free food, and beer courtesy of Amun-Ra. Suddenly, an intense bright object was spotted low in the night sky. Thousands witnessed it, named Sahagug, the demon. The anomaly with two piercing lights moved about, reached out and carried off people, according to the reports, cut tongues, left and returned, and silenced mouths, according to the reports. There was a possibility that it traveled 400 miles to northern cities during its journey. That's open. The first report by a young scribe and a temple servant showed puzzlement and fear. The second report, 35 statements by a group of scribes and priests of affiliated temples of Horus, Osiris, left no doubt to its purpose. They called it evil and wanted it gone. Egyptologists who categorize it as magic have largely ignored this event. The Griffith Institute, Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, England, has accepted my work, Journey of a Demon, as I used some ostraca belonging to the museum in my paper. They put it in their library and so forth. I won't go any more. That's basically what it is.
Wow.
So I have an exact translation of what it was. What happened was, like I said, they would have a watch. Apparently, the star Sept would appear just before the Nile would flood. So they kicked this thing up. They looked for the star, and they had a thing called Ger en Secher Aset Rezut, or the night in the passing of the Isis watch. Isis was identified with the star Sept, which we know is Sirius. Okay?
Okay.
And her name is, by the way, every female name, it ends in a T, so it wasn't Cleopatra, it's Cleopatra, and it wasn't Isis, it was Aset. And these are the correct names. Okay? It wasn't Horus, it was Hedu. It wasn't Osiris, it was Osir, and so forth. The correct names are ignored, but they're there. You can find them.
Right,
there's
wow.
No problem. So anyway, they apparently, I guess what happened was this young scribe and this temple servant went up on the roof and saw this thing, and he apparently with an oil lamp, he put this down on a stone slice. And the amazing thing that we're talking about this today, 3,200 years ago, that this thing has survived. Now the first report was picked up by the Germans in around 1900. I don't have the exact date. It was destroyed at the Leipzig Museum during World War II, but not before it was photographed and not before it was copied very elaborately and correctly. So we know it was the second report, the one with all the details. It's in the Ashmolean Museum, the Griffith Institute in Oxford, Great Britain. So it the evidence is there.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a real event.
Yeah. Now you want to know what was going on? Okay. This thing appeared, and the scribe, I will translate, I'm looking at it in the wall right now, and he says, "Hail thee, these Sahagag." And I'll just read it right off of the report here. And he says, "Hail thee, Sahagag, coming forth from Sept." Well, he figured it was coming forth. That was the night of Isis, and Sept was Sirius. So he, more or less a play on words, he's coming forth from, or being born. The other report says being born of Isis. Get it? Isis, the star, being born of, right, on the same night? Yeah. You know, they were very clever with that. Okay. With his front he does see. With his jaw he eateth upon talk cakes from the right or west. He's seeing this thing coming down from this entity, which he likens to a sphinx in the sky, like a shtar. The ancient Egyptian word shtar means a sphinx, couchant, what do you call it, laying out, like a lion lays out, like the sphinx lays out, you know?
Right.
They don't know how to identify this thing. They're trying to think, what does it look like? He likens it to a lion. Both reports liken it to a lion. Now, you want to know why they liken it to a lion? Because if you were in the wilderness of ancient Kemet, and you were in the evening, and it got started to get cold, and you had a little fire going there, and you felt someone looking at you from behind, and you turned around, and the light from the fire reflected in the eyes of a lion in back of you, what would you feel? And that's what he felt. That's the deal about it. He likens it to the lion.
Well, people relate the UFO phenomenon to their culture, like,
yes,
the Romans.
Exactly, because they have no other way of it. They were very afraid of lions. They're very, you know, the lions, they didn't want anything to do with them. But anyway, so this thing goes on. He says, they are doomed, the star god. See him live with his front. A part of this is broken away, but not a lot. And then broken. Mysteries in the southern sky. Now, he means southern, not cardinal point, but as southern Egypt and northern Egypt, they used to be two different countries. So he means the southern Egypt, and now we know where it was located, where it came out at night. It was in the city of Wass, the capital. We know that happened at that height of that celebration. And we know the date, because that's when Sirius appeared, with the 20th and the 29th of July, according to the records. Wow. So we even have a date on it within 20 days. They are doomed, the star gods, and it says, mysteries in the southern sky. He is fear. He is fear. Then it says, broken. As in the mountains, the strong lions meet, but who? What? Like, who? What are you? You know what I mean? And he says, not the soul of Shatha, some obscure god, the name of, and it's so obscure he was going to put the name broken. Then he says, unknown. And then that part of it's broken out, unknown. Then the last one, thou goest away. And I won't go into what it sounds like in the ancient language, but I have it. The first line is, Enecharake Sahagag per Sept, means Hail of the Sahaga coming from Sept, and so forth. That was the first report. Apparently they took the back of it, there was something written on it. And he says, the people, this was the verso side of the Ostraca 1 piece, I call it. The people gave to me on account of me, they gave behind the sanctuary words. This was the temple of Hadusa Asad, or Horus, son of Isis, temple that I think he was affiliated with. I think they found these in the ruins of the temple. Placed upon the linen for flower offerings, it was done with spears by the people. He was given talk cakes from the part of that's broken. What was done with spears? Is it a ceremonial thing, or did we have, being spears, it means with armor. Did we have a police presence? Was it getting out of hand? We don't know. In other words, you would say it was done with weaponry. You don't know whether you meant as far as the offering or what.
Okay.
That is open. Okay, then we're moving along here. So let's move to 02. 02 is the second report. Okay, after I found the second report, here's what happened. Amun Ra was a big kid in the block. He was getting all the government subsidies, okay? All right. The temple, one side of this temple was about a mile and a half long. It was huge. this guy had, you know, lots of money, or well, the equivalent. They didn't use money, but lots of riches in this temple. But the other religion, the other priests and all, that had to do with Horus and Isis and all that, they were there. They were there at the festival because it had to do with Isis anyway. That was their goddess. You know, the one was Sept or Sirius. So they were there, and they were trying to figure it out. So they all got together, and they were kicking this ball around, saying, what is this thing? So the second report is they're offering up of this thing. And it's interesting, very interesting what they're saying, because it sounds like right out of some of the UFO sightings today. I'm going to read it right exactly. Get thee back. Now, the first report says, hail to thee, okay? The second one says, get thee back, or hake sagat per sept. It says per pet, per and pet. Get thee back, Sahagug, coming forth from the sky. By the way, the name Sahagug, Huk means disruptor. S is actually causative formation. It means it's internalized. And saying it fast, like Huk Huk, it's Sahagug. So you mean actually it's double disruptor, double destroyer, okay? You're putting it doubly together.
Coming from the sky.
Exactly. Wow. Yeah, coming from the sky. Okay, get thee back. He sees with his front. His two legs are at tail end. Okay, that's power source. He eats tall cakes from under him. Now, this is a second report. He's talking about something going. Now, what a tall cake is like a roll, like a bun or a roll, a small dinner roll, or I can't say a donut, but something like that, a pastry, coming up into the mouth of this thing. As he's visualizing it as a lion lying down with two lights, because that's all I can figure that the thing is. They see a black, some kind of shape up there. How could they describe a craft?
Right.
You know? So they see this thing coming up, and there's something coming down, and first one thought it was a jawbone. The second one thought it was actually, it was the second report, it was like a beam of light that was coming down and picking up these things, a tongue. They thought, you know, a frog sticks his tongue out and snaps up a fly,
right,
like that, okay? Because they knew animals. They knew all the animals very well.
Right. This is fascinating stuff, and this is what you call theory escalation.
Yes, well, the only thing is nothing else fits. I mean, you can say, well, I'm throwing this out because I'm trying to put myself looking through their eyes, because nothing else fits. You can't start talking about planes and balloons and things like that. And of course, they knew the stars. They knew all about the stars. They also had an expression for wandering stars that was very ancient. They had the Segedu and the Nimmu, and those words mean wandering stars, and they weren't comets either. They had another word for comets. So that wasn't. Anyway, let's get back onto this. His power is in his traveling, kapesh, or animal leg propulsion. His eastern power is in his reaching out, extending authority. He is fear to the gods of Netakert. Netakert is the what we call the underworld or the other world. To snare or net is thy power. When thou leaves, thou returns. Thou snatches or grabs ears, like a rabbit, you know, grabbing an animal.
Right.
Thou sealest mouths. Thou cut tongues. A holy father of the temple, a holy one among those of Anu. These are different opinions. Thou shalt not fall far from thy exalted hand. Born at night, in daytime, often or all hours. It was he in the guard form of a son of Isis, Saaset. Now, because he arrived, in other words, well, he must be related to Isis because he was born on her night. Okay? That's just a play on words in a way, but, okay. A blood relation of Osiris-Nefer or Osiris-Unefer. Repeating, hail to thee, brings him back. Thou showest thyself as a lion-type, fierce-eyed god, Hesa, son of Bas. In their temples, they would take a statue, and they would have marble eyes, and they'd put a candle in the back of it, and when someone would come in, it'd be like a lion face, and the thing would light up from behind. They had that deal with the lion eyes. They're very much into that, and that's what they identified that with those two lights. Okay, so Hesa was this lion god, son of Bas, who was a cat goddess. With his wrecking, overturning, casting out with thy body. Now, what he said, he says, thou changest thy skin before the lords of Anu. What he actually says is, when a person in ancient Egypt dies,
They put a tent over the body. That is the ones that have money. And it's called a mezca. It's a leather tent. And their soul can then leave in privacy under this tent. And it's called a mezca. A mezca-e is the ability of being covered with the mezca. And the thing says mezca-ike in Bachna Nebuana, which means thou did a mezca-e, you did a mezca-e in front of the lords of Anu, in front of the city fathers. In other words, this thing's up there covered, this craft or whatever it is covered with this thing.
Okay.
And it looks to them, if you take a B-2 bomber, okay, and throw a tent over it, what is it going to look like? It's going to look very similar to that. See, and like a dead body. You take a B-2 bomber and look at the head of it, the cabin, and then go back to the foot,
right,
feet in the back, horizontally. They considered it kind of like a shape like that of a horizontal a body laying out. They were trying to put it into something they understood, you know.
Right.
Okay. Let's see. Rebel, the name of thy father, when thou appearest before man in the west, east, north, or south of the sky, the gods, and it's broken. But it means he was all over the place. If he's appearing in all these different directions, thy power is in the west. Get this. The ancient words are chaucher remen entike. To reach out and carry off is who thou art. Chaucherem and entike. Now you say, well, yeah, maybe they meant something else. Okay, let me explain real quickly. The words were phonetic, okay, hieroglyphic or hieratic. Hieratic, same thing.
Right.
But at the end of each word, they had what I call an identifier. And the word would be an identifier. If you saw saw gasoline in some Oriental language, you didn't know what it was, but you saw a shell emblem, you'd know it was gasoline. You know, so they did that at the end of the word. Okay, chao, to reach out, her, toward. Remen is the word, or ermen, or remen. Remen is to carry off. You know what the identifier is for that sound system, remen? It's a hawk's leg and claw, to carry off. You ever see a hawk pick up a kitten?
Right, so it's like a duck.
Okay. No, you can't confuse this. You can't say, you know, well, they meant something. No, they meant to carry off. Is who you are. Okay, I thought that was about the best one. Departer thy name by the ability of expelling thy body. A little bit of, you know, shape-shifting? I don't know. To give, thy soul, this brokenness, is to give thee a name of evil. Do not travel to the city of Dedu. That's another city. Not may be seen thy front to the city of Abdu. These are cities up the coast. Because you cause flooding at Far. Far is 400 miles to the north. Whether he did or not, they attributed the damage to him, which means that apparently he was, you know, he was there maybe, possibly, don't quite know. Then he says, sign Behent Medet, staff of the follower of the unseen Horus. And that was the second report. That was done 30 years later. We won't have time to explain why, because there's just not enough time in the program. But any questions, Preston, about this? We have 15 minutes left, I believe.
This is really an incredible story. I mean, so could this have been like a wave of sightings?
No, I think what it was, I think this had happened before, but like so many things, it's kind of like, you know, a UFO appears at an airport and all the passengers go their way and then, you know, it's forgotten. Well, you got a large amount of people. And it was almost like they deliberately did this. I mean, if they did it today, there'd be mass chaos, you know. It'd be when in danger and in doubt, run in circles, scream and shout. Because they were right at the height of this festival. Now this happened at night, initially. As it said in the second report, you appeared at night, initially, you know. Okay. You've got all these campfires going on. You've got an excess amount of people around the city, around the hill, you know, around the area in the outskirts of the city. They can't all fit in the city, so they're all around the hills waiting. And between Karnak and what we call Karnak and Luxor today, which wasn't their real names then. But anyway, they're waiting for this procession. What they would do would they take the god Amun-Ra and they put him in, it was a small golden statue, and they'd show it to the people once a year. And they'd go this elaborate, they'd carry this small boat, gilded boat, and they'd put it on a big boat, and Pharaoh would be there. So it was a big deal. Plus they were providing free beer and meat sources, you know, like goose and so on. People were having a ball. And so they were enjoying the heck out of this, and I'm sure they had all kind of extra food there and specialty stuff and everything, and it was a big get-together. And they had a 20-day holiday.
Right.
So it was a special event. Well, they saw this thing, and I imagine Pharaoh was kind of ticked off. He probably went to the head priest of Amun-Ra and say, "What is going on here?" And the other religion, the one that was the one that wasn't so powerful, they were the ones that wrote all this down. They're trying to, what's in this for us? You know, this is going to knock down the power of Amun-Ra. Well, like so many UFO sightings, it apparently left after a while. And life went back to normal. But these recordings, this writing down, and like I said, the one thing this country did more than almost any other country was they recorded everything.
Right.
And that's one thing. The second thing is, more than they do today, judging from our news media, the second thing that they did was they were honest. The reporting, the scribes were probably had a beaten end of them, to be honest. That was very high in their religion.
This is apparent from your readings of the
other stuff. I've checked that out. So I tried. I went through all this, and I would do a whole page on every line. I'd dissect each line. I'd say, okay, maybe this is wrong. Maybe it was a comment. I tried to make it into something else.
Well, when did it become apparent to you? Do you think that this was probably a UFO they're talking about?
Well, early on, but I didn't know the extent, and I also didn't know for 15 years about this second report. I was just going on the first report.
Wow.
The second report, they mentioned the two lights. Because it says here, in the back, it says, we didn't get to that part yet. He says, thine eye, this is the one, line 23. Thine eyes behold thee with thy front. Okay, now Egyptians draw from the side. They don't have two eyes staring at it. You ever see a front on of any Egyptian art? Not on the walls. They're always from the side.
Wow.
And that's from 6,000-7,000 years ago. They always did that because that's the way they drew. Okay, they just never stopped. They never liked to change things, okay? Once they established something, they left it that way. And so they didn't have two eyes. This thing had two eyes. That is to say, two lights. It was a god up there that they didn't know what it was initially. And, you know, then they realized it was no good. It was a demon, and apparently the word got back what it was doing, and they wanted it gone.
Wow.
So here you have what happened after that? What was the outcome of it? Well, it didn't disrupt the religion of Amun-Ra. Was strong enough and had enough, riches to continue on. They ended up ruining the country. They had their own pharaoh in there, and they just, you know, you don't want to mess around too much with religion and politics, and this is a very good example. But the other religions continued on. That is to say, the one of Asit and so forth. There was also another event that we've got to have to really hit on because this has to do with more UFOs. There was a place called Edfu, which was approximately 60 miles south of Wast, the real name of Thebes, what they call, these are all Greek names, Thebes. Wast was the real name. Okay, it was also called New Amun, or Amun City. New is city.
Okay,
so there was a place called Heru Behudet. Heru was Horus, and Behudet means literally Carver City. Okay?
All right.
Well, the people that lived down there, apparently they came in there and they just kicked butt and took over the area thousands of years ago, and they worked with iron and strange metals.
Huh.
Okay. I'm going to read exactly what they were talking about, because they're talking about, this was apparently, this was from the Book of the Dead, but they said, when you they're talking about Heru. Now, Heru is an ancient god that was way almost from the beginning of their dynasties and so forth. He said, it says here, talking about this, is, by the way, this is called Horus of Behudet. It's the chapter Horus of Behudet out of the Gods of the Egyptians by E.A. Wallace Budge, page 476. I'm not making any of this up. He's talking about the foundry. Okay, it says, the place where tradition declared he first established himself as the great master blacksmith. Okay, it says, when the doors of the foundry are opened, the disc rises up. Now, let's stop right here. You all see the picture that disc with the wings on it in ancient Egypt?
Sure, yeah.
That's no sun. That's no sun.
Which is the popular explanation.
Yeah. But the Egyptologists, they're talking about the sun. No, they're not talking about the sun. Sorry. It says here, the disc rises up, and it says, I'm quoting right out of the book, page 477. Heru-Bekhodet flew up to heaven in the form of a winged disc, a flying disc, and ever after he was called Great God, Lord of Heaven. And it says, from the height of heaven he was able to see his father's enemies, and he chased them. Now, the sun doesn't go chasing around the heavens. He chased them in the form of a great winged or flying disc. He attacked them with such wrath and vigor that they lost their senses and could neither see with their eyes nor hear with their ears. And every man fell upon his neighbor and slew him. And in a moment all were dead. And straight away Heru, Horus, with many colored shapes and feathers, or maybe colors, you were talking about colors earlier about the UFOs,
right,
returned to his form as a winged disc and took up his position in the boat of Ra. Now what's the boat of Ra? Is this the sun boat or is this the mothership?
a flying disc, a ship.
This was so ingrained in there. They held this. This is so ancient. This book is so old. When they found this thing, they're still arguing over how old it is. Roughly 6,000 years ago, they found this Peremkru, or coming forth by day, this Book of the Dead, that has these quotes in there. That means, they said, in the ancient commissions had trouble, you know, translating it because it was so ancient. That puts that 1 to 2,000 years older. So from 6 to 8,000 years ago, they're talking about an aerial battle with something not unlike a disc. You know, and so it's right here in the book. You can read it. Anyone can get this book. Anyone buy it. Dover, I'm sure it's still, and so forth like that. It tells more about it. But he's called the Great Protector. And here's the funny thing. Every temple in ancient Egypt, every religion, and there were a lot of them, that was, you know, all had the winged disc over the doorways to protect them from the enemy, from danger. It's a protection sign today. It is a sign of protection.
Now, don't they have, like, legends in Egyptian mythology of wise beings that come from the sky and teach agriculture and stuff like this?
Yes, yes. The greatest god was Tehuti, which we know the Greeks called Thoth, and that was the scribe's god. And that's the one that taught the honesty, and he taught the gods knowledge. Tehuti, that's why the scribes liked him so much. Okay,
wow.
He was held in high regard. But my spin on it is this: I think that these people they're talking about, these so-called gods or so-called myth, they were pilots. They were people who came here, and they had some battles going on apparently, and the battles go on. They go on and on with this thing. They were attacking them in the water. And it said they looked like they were attacking what they thought were hippopotamuses and alligators or crocodiles. Were they ships? Were they submarines? I don't know, but it goes on where they attacked them 2 or 3 times with these, you know, in the form of a disc.
Wow.
And that's right here in the book. I mean, it's, you know, like I said, and I also, the Book of the Dead, the master copy of it, it mentions all kind of things like that, where there was a group of people called the Hemamet beings, the beings of light. And it says, when I have seen, and you know, it says it's supposed to be in the underworld or the afterworld. It says, I have seen the gods and I have seen the Hemamet beings, separate entities. Who are the Hemamet beings? The Greys?
Huh. It could be.
But that's, and none of this, the deal is, none of this is ever brought out. None of this is in our school system. I don't talk about the stuff about the UFO angle, but even the basics of ancient Kemet, it's never brought out. There's no record. The people are going to college, universities, and other than studying Egyptology, they're never going to get this information except through your program.
Right, and as you said, even the Egyptologists can't agree on what's
No, they
on.
Don't like to touch it. I went to a, I'm not going to say what place it was locally here in San Diego County. The guy was teaching, he was translating hieroglyphics for people to go over to Egypt, and they do some rubbings and they translate some of the cartouches. And so someone asked a question. They said, on the Rosetta Stone, they said there were 3 languages. One was Greek and one was hieroglyphic, and they said, what was the third one? Someone said, oh, was that Amoraic? And the teacher didn't know what to say because he didn't know. And it was not. It was a later form of hieratic called Demotic.
Wow.
And I was sitting there in that class as a guest, and I didn't want to embarrass the teacher, but he didn't know.
Wow.
He didn't know. So I don't know what to say. And again, I'm not against Egyptologists. Some of these people, if it wasn't for them, you know, just because we have a guy that doesn't know a Demotic, it doesn't mean that all the Egyptologists don't know what they're very, very, very good at what they do.
No, it's a fascinating subject, and obviously a lot of people are really interested in it. It's the dawn of civilization, pretty much, huh?
Oh, it is. There's so much, and there's so much still to translate and to there's a lot of stuff that isn't uncovered yet.
Wow. Well, you know, we're approaching our last few minutes.
Yes.
Boy, everyone, we're listening to Ed McBride. We're talking about UFOs over ancient Egypt. And, Ed, you're just, it amazes me how much information you have, and I imagine we've only just scratched the surface.
I was glad we were able to get it in.
But definitely, this is, you're definitely going to have to write a book about this, because...
Yeah, I'm thinking about it.
Really?
I really am.
I mean, you're the guy to do it. You've obviously got this information down. So... I mean, we've got like 1 minute. Is there anything you want to leave people with?
No, I was just glad to get an opportunity to get the message out for people. Maybe it'll just get them thinking a little bit more about it and poking around a few books and see what they can find.
Right. Wow, it's a fascinating subject. I mean, I knew UFOs have been around a long time, but whew, it's amazing. I mean, it sounds like there were possibly some abductions going on in that evening.
Yeah, there were. There were. It's nothing new.
Okay. Well, everyone, that's our show for this evening. I want to thank you all for listening. Our guest has been Ed McBride. We've been talking about UFOs over ancient Egypt. Thank you, Ed, for coming out of the show.
It's been a lot of fun.
All right. Well, until next week, guys, I'm going to have another exciting guest. But until then, keep your eyes on the skies and have a great evening.